Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Trita Parsi, who is president of the National Iranian American Council and adjunct professor of international relations at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. His new book is Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the U.S. Trita, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Iran, southern Iran, in the Khuzestan region. And my family left Iran right before the revolution in Iran, late 1978. And I grew up in Sweden. And I did most of my schooling in Sweden, but I've been living in the United States off and on from 1990s and permanently since 2001.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, it was being born at that time, going through the revolution, going through the Iran-Iraq war, it's very difficult not to have been influenced by politics per se. So from a very early age, I've been obviously very interested in politics because it was so defining everything we were doing. The fact that we had to leave Iran, the fact my dad was both in the Shah's prison and in Khomeini's prison later on. These things definitely affect the way that you look at things.
And was he a political activist?
He wasn't a political activist, but he was critical of some of the policies of the Shah. And as a result, he ended up in jail during the time of the Shah. And then later on, when the revolution occurred, they accused him of having been a collaborator with the Savak, which was not true. And he actually went back to clear his name, and he ended up in jail during Khomeini's time now, in Khomeini's jail. But he did clear his name, and he came back to Sweden.
So was it almost inevitable that you would pursue academic studies in international politics?
I think, you know, those things that happened at the age of five, when I was only 5 years old, definitely had a tremendously large impact on the way the rest of my life would develop. Yeah.
Where did you do your undergraduate work?
I did a degree in political science at Uppsala University in Sweden, which is one of Sweden's oldest universities, and a master's in economics at Stockholm School of Economics. And then I came to the United States to do my PhD at Johns Hopkins.
Now, you are an international relation realist. What are the big picture items that a realist such as yourself brings to the table to affect his perspective on what he sees in the region?
Well, I think one of the biggest advantages of realism, it's at times a very simple theory, but also a very sophisticated one, an elegant one in that. It's the focus on power as being the key variable. And obviously, power cannot be an explanatory factor for everything, but it is probably the most decisive factor. And I think it does help a lot because it enables you to see through all these various factors and all these different variables and be able to see the ones that are most important. And particularly when it comes to foreign policy making and the fact that every government has an interest in being able to conceal its true policies and its true interests by using rhetoric, by using ideology, etc. Being able to skim through that and actually go to the core of the matter.
As a realist, when you look at the world, you're interested in the relations of each of the states to each other to help you get a sense of what the world looks like.
Exactly. I mean, the realists are looking at the states. The states are the actors in a realist perspective. They're not looking inside of the state. They're looking at the relationship between the states. And they're treating the states as units that are the same. They're the same units in the sense that they're all pursuing their own interest. And there's not really a lot of moralizing taking place here. International relations is seen as an amoral activity, and morality does not really come into play because decision makers cannot use personal morality to make decisions for states. And as a result, oftentimes I think actually that helps analyze the situation because you take away some of these aspects that make it so much more complicated, and you're bringing a moral dimension that only tends to make the analysis more blurry in my view.
Mm-hmm. But the test, I guess, becomes because you did define as your problem weighing the ideological aspects versus the aspects of geopolitics. You do have to get into the inside, right,
of
the individual actors.
Absolutely. But you also, certainly you have to get into the inside. And what I did for the book is that I did about 130 interviews with decision makers in all three countries. And I think that's one of the biggest contributions in the book, because the last book written on Iran and Israel was written in 1987 by an Israeli journalist, an excellent book by Samuel Segev. But it's a book that is based almost solely on interviews with Israeli officials and Israeli documents. It didn't have access to the full picture. So in the interviews, there's a tremendous amount of discussion then about what was the motivating factors, why did this decision be made at this specific time, and then trying to see, so what were the factors that were driving these decisions? Was it the ideological outlook of these individuals and these states? Was it the fact that Iran was now an ideological fundamentalist state? Was that the primary factor that was coloring every decision they were making? And if that was the case, how would their decisions be looking? And if it wasn't the case, why wasn't it?
As you lay out your plan of study, what I want our audience to understand to what it is you're accomplishing here, because in my view it's impressive. Namely, you are looking at Iran, you are looking at Israel, and their competition for leadership in the Middle East, and how that competition is affected and affects its relationship to the United States. And so let's talk a little about that big picture as you see it as a realist.
Since 1991-93, when you had the end of the Cold War, what happens there is basically that the two factors that had pushed Iran and Israel closer together during the Cold War, the two common threats that they sensed, the Soviet Union and Iraq, were basically eliminated. The Soviet Union collapsed, and Iraq, though it wasn't eliminated, it was significantly weakened and defeated. And as a result, an entirely new power structure in the Middle East emerged. Reconfiguration of the geopolitical map of the Middle East, in which Iran and Israel now stood out as two of the most powerful states in the region. And this created a new situation. On the one hand, they felt that they were unchecked. There was no countries in between them that were powerful enough that could ensure that they couldn't become potential threats to each other. And at the same time, this effort to create a new order in the Middle East, which is essentially an effort to lock in a favorable balance of power, so that position that you're holding would be able to survive even when the underlying balance has shifted. That pits the most powerful states in the region against each other. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've seen ever since that year.
And I want to emphasize for our audience that what before the end of the Cold War, the international structure, the global structure, was bipolar, with a competition between the Soviet Union and the United States. And once the Soviet Union fell, then the only superpower was the United States, and hence an important actor for the region.
Absolutely. Not only because it's a superpower now, but because the United States enters the region through the Persian Gulf War and has a large military presence in the region as a result. And now, if you are seeking a preeminent role in the region, you cannot balance the United States by turning to the Soviet Union, because it no longer existed. There's no other major pole in the world at the global level. So it was necessary, if you want to reach that position of preeminence, to improve your relations with the United States. And this is exactly the direction that the Iranians were trying to go. But now, from the Israeli perspective, there was a fear that if the United States and Iran were to improve their relations, if they were to have a rapprochement, it would change Israel's significance in the Middle East, and a deal could come at the expense of Israel's security interests, which was a remarkable shift in the Israeli position, because throughout the 1980s, it was Israel who had been lobbying the United States, talk to Iran, sell arms to Iran, ignore Iranian rhetoric because it's not reflective of their true policy. We need Iran on the western side of the camp, and we needed to balance the Arabs. And now there was a complete shift. Now it was an effort to prevent that dialogue from taking place.
Now, when the Soviet Union collapsed and the first President Bush was in the White House and Dick Cheney was Secretary of Defense, there was an effort to redefine America's global role. And there was a document, a Pentagon guidance document, which was leaked to the press, then withdrawn because of the controversy. And that document actually relates to the discussion we're about to have, because it said that the U.S. should prevent the rise of any hegemon in any region of the world, lest that hegemon threaten America's global hegemony. That fits into all of this, does it not?
And it's critical. And if you take a look at it in a historical perspective, the United States, or take it from the Iranian perspective, the Iranians have, throughout history, played a preeminent role in the region because of their conventional natural conventional superiority. They've always had an interest in making sure that the Persian Gulf is part of the sphere of influence. And it's very difficult to imagine any Iran that wouldn't be doing so. Mm-hmm. When the Brits left the Persian Gulf in 1971 and they withdraw from everything east of the Suez, Iran saw its opportunity to emerge as the major power, and it needed America's blessing, and it got it from the Nixon administration through the twin pillar policy. Once Iran attained that position, its critical interest was to make sure that the superpowers, its rivals, would never get a pretext to re-enter the Persian Gulf. And it's critical to understand that the Iranians, under the Shah, a very close friend of the United States, still viewed the United States as a potential rival. It was not a hostile rival, but it was still a rival. It didn't want the United States to come into the region because then Iran would lose its preeminent position. Now, the Iranians were playing that game, and it was irritating to the United States to a certain extent, but it was under the shadow of a much larger conflict, which was the Cold War, in which the United States needed Iran as a bulwark against Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. So the Iranian power games had a far less of an importance back then than it did because of the Cold War. But by 1991, once the Soviet Union had fallen, then that issue came to the fore. And now the United States was saying that in these critical areas, such as the Persian Gulf, because of its energy resources, the United States cannot permit any power to emerge mm-hmm. as a regional superpower.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we look at the two states that you're focused on, Iran and Israel, it's very interesting that you find great continuities between the regimes, despite their very different character. So, in the case of the Shah, we have a secular modernizer who uses repression. In the case of the Khomeini and the regime that followed, we have a theological, religious regime. But in fact, both have very great similarities in the way they behave in the region.
Absolutely. And this is, again, something I think is much easier to be able to discern if you approach it from a realist perspective, mm-hmm. because you know which variables to take a look at, and you don't get, your attention is not put away towards other issues that are less important. But when you take a look at Iranian foreign policy, you see a tremendous amount of continuity. Iran has an ambition of being a preeminent power in the region, which means that it will play its neighbors in such a way that is quite similar during the time of the Shah and during the time of Khomeini. If ideology had been a decisive factor in Iranian foreign policy, you would have seen a major shift in Israeli-Iranian relations in the 1980s. On the surface level, you certainly did see a shift. And in many ways, the Iranians changed their behavior. They stopped selling the oil, or tried to at least. But in reality, because of the security imperatives in which now Iran was at war with an Arab state.
Namely Iraq.
And Israel was one of the few countries, if not the only one, that was able and willing to help the Iranians access American weaponry and American spare parts. The Iranians needed Israel, and the Israelis were more than keen to reach out to the Iranians. So behind the scene, you see a continuation of a policy quite similar to what existed in the 1970s during the time of the Shah. But on the surface, you see a completely different picture.
Mm-hmm. Now, it is important for whatever regime is in power in Iran that they come up with a formula for dealing with issues such as the Palestinians, the on-again, off-again peace process in the region, the whole question of religious sites in Israel and so on. These issues come up again and again, and there is some variation in not necessarily the overall position, but on the emphasis and the difference between rhetoric and operational policy.
Absolutely, absolutely. You see it. Iran has a contradiction in its security approach, because on the one hand, in the short term, it has oftentimes needed Israel in order to be able to balance the Arab states that it's seen as a threat. But in the long run, the Iranians have recognized, both the Shah as well as the Khomeini government, that it needs to find a formula to make friends with its permanent Arab neighbors, and that it cannot do so by constantly seeking to balance them by having alliances with foreign powers, external powers. So the Iranians have oftentimes used the anti-Israel card to create a common denominator between themselves and the Arab states in order to be able to improve that relationship, bridge the Arab-Persian divide, bridge the Sunni-Shiite divide, and make sure that Iran could find less tense relations with its immediate as well as its permanent neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Now, Khomeini substituted the notion of political Islam as the ideology. And he initially thought that he could use that to overcome the Arab-Persian divide.
Correct.
But there's a volcano under there, absolutely, which is the Sunni-Shia split, which becomes increasingly important today.
It became important back then as well, but more than anything else, while the Iranians were trying to bridge that divide and they were trying to play the political Islam, what they managed to do was to truly scare the Arab governments, because the Arab governments felt that this was a threat, an ideological threat and a political threat to their position. And Iran, in the beginning of the revolution, had a policy of regime change. It was trying to export its revolution. It was trying to replace the monarchies in the Persian Gulf with states that were constructed in a similar way as Iran, with a similar political Islamic outlook. But it was, again, a vehicle that the Iranians were trying to use to be able to gain that position of preeminence. Because this is a critical point. Iran may have a tremendous amount of power, and on numerous occasions in history has had that, but it cannot reach that position of preeminence unless it has buy-in from its neighbors. They need to accept and legitimize Iran's position. And to do so, Iran, during the time of the Shah, was playing the American card. It was an ally of the United States, and it still didn't manage to fully get it because its relations with Israel were seen as being too close by the Arabs. Come the 1980s, the Iranians were trying to use political Islam to do so, but that required a replacement of the governments in the Arab world, and that was not possible. Mm-hmm. So in both cases, the Iranians failed.
Mm-hmm. There is this sense that when you're talking to a realist, that there's an automaticity about what's being described. This is not just a criticism of you, but it's a criticism that you can make against realists that does not take into account the nuances of the domestic situation. And I want you to comment on that, you know, in light of the extent to which we've come to realize how fragmented the Iranian governmental structure is, the conflict between reformers and conservatives, between secularists and religious types, and so on. So why are you comfortable in using your theory to essentially put this aside? Although I recognize that your book is very rich in its descriptive detail.
Thank you. And it was a very good question. And as you mentioned, in the book, there is quite a lot of discussion about the tensions, not only on the Iranian side, but also on the Israeli mm-hmm. side. It's very fascinating shifts and challenges internally in Israel. But I would approach it in this way. I think it is very important to recognize that domestic factors do matter. But at the same time, the question is, to what extent do they matter, and are they take precedent over other factors such as the regional structure. And in the case of Iran, I think we see two factors that, in my view, make the realist perspective superior. On the one hand, you have a region that is almost constantly in geopolitical flux. And secondly, the Iranians do not have sufficient amount of power to permit the internal decisions take the country in a direction that is at odds with geopolitical forces. If Iran was in the position of the United States, for instance, in which it was a very powerful state, then yes. And you can see how those internal matters, those ideological perspectives, can shift the country in a specific direction. But even in the case of the United States, I think we've seen that clearly now in the last 7 years. You have a policy that is driven to a large extent by ideology, but even the sole superpower runs into a wall and recognizes that it needs to go back to more realist policies. And that's exactly what we've seen in the Middle East. We've seen how the Iraq War and the failure there have caused a backlash against the ideologues in the United States and ascendancy of the realist. And I think it shows the tensions. And I think it shows that if a country is very powerful and it is in a somewhat comfortable position, the domestic factors can become decisive. But when they're not, which is the case of Iran in the last 30 years, then the realist factors, the international structure, becomes more decisive.
Let's talk a little about Israel, because with this end of bipolarity that you've discussed, the rise of the U.S. as the only superpower in the world, Israel's policies and strategies had to change. Why and what did they do?
Well, Israel played a critical role for the United States during the Cold War. It was an outpost of the United States in the Middle East in a way. It was a bulwark against Soviet penetration. And it had proven itself to be a reliable and a strong ally, particularly after the 1967 war. But come the end of the Cold War, you have a completely new situation. And in the way that the Cold War ended and in the way that Saddam Hussein was defeated, that created a tremendous amount of tension and apprehension in Israel. Because the United States during the Bush administration, the senior Bush administration, put together an international alliance to evict Saddam from Kuwait. And it was critical for the United States to make sure that the Arab states were included in that alliance. So the Bush administration spent a tremendous amount of political capital putting together this Arab alliance within the international alliance. And to do so, they had to basically promise two things. First, that if the Arabs helped the United States against Iraq, which would be an unprecedented case, a large coalition of Arabs fighting another Arab state, the United States would have to come and put pressure on Israel after the war to make compromises with the Palestinians. Secondly, in order for the Arabs to remain in the coalition, Israel needed to be kept out. And so now suddenly Israel was in a situation in which the United States was visiting with almost every Arab state in the region, many of them at odds with Israel. And it was doing everything to make sure that Israel was as far away from the United States as possible. Israel was started to be treated as a burden rather than an asset. Mm-hmm. And come the Madrid conference after the war, you know, the United States basically had to drag Yitzhak Shamir to the conference. He would not want to participate in that. And this created, again, a tremendous amount of tensions between the United States and Israel. The United States and Israel had a low in their relationship, probably the deepest low that they've had during that period. And then there was an additional factor. If now the United States is going to cozy up to the Arabs, and in addition to that, have a rapprochement with Iran, an Islamic fundamentalist state in the region, which could offer the United States tremendous strategic benefits because of its position in the region, because of its energy resources, because of its access to the Caspian Sea and the energy resources there, then where would that leave Israel in the strategic outlook of the United States? This was a major challenge that Israel was facing.
Mm-hmm. Israel was dealing with a number of domestic problems about which it had to shift its position. I have in mind here the occupation, the territories. Would there be a peace process with the Palestinians? And it saw that it had to respond to the U.S. Urgency in wanting to resolve the questions of war and peace with regard to the Palestinians. So how did this change in Israeli policy under Rabin toward embracing the Oslo peace process affect Israel's position vis-a-vis Iran?
It was defining. As you mentioned, in Israel, the Intifada had continued for quite some time. There was a surprise in Israel to the tenacity of the Intifada, how long it could keep on. And there was a feeling also that this was corrupting Israel's youth. This was creating major problems for Israel. It was not worth the cost. And there was a necessity to be able to find a new equation there. And at the same time, there was a recognition, particularly in the Labour Party, that there was a need for a new regional outlook. Israel had been guided for several decades, off and on, with varying intensity, by a doctrine called the Doctrine of the Periphery. The idea that Israel needed to guarantee its security, the best way of securing itself, was by creating alliances with the non-Arab states in the periphery of the Middle East. Basically, Turkey, Ethiopia, and most importantly, Iran. In order to weaken the vicinity, the Arab vicinity, the inner and the outer circle of the region. But now, because of the geopolitical shift, because of the defeat of Saddam Hussein, the vicinity was no longer a conventional military threat to Israel. The threat came primarily from inside Israel because of the occupation, because of its loss of a strategic significance to the United States, and then potentially, from Iran as a powerful periphery power. So there was a recognition in Israel that they needed to invert the periphery doctrine. Now the vicinity was needed to be befriended in order to be able to face off a potential threat from Iran. And the threat from Iran at the time was highly exaggerated by the Israelis. And it was deliberately done so as a political tool of convincing the Israeli public that now, after two generations of growing up seeing the Palestinians as mortal enemies, they're suddenly peace partners. And if you want to make them peace partners, you need a more ominous threat down on the horizon. And that threat was Iran.
I want to ask you a question at this point, and this goes back to the realist perspective. And I, as you were speaking, I thought of this issue. I'm worried that it's going to rain outside. I'm overly paranoid about it raining, and so I'm always have my umbrella in hand. Come across today, and it is in fact raining. Basically, and I have my umbrella, and so I'm responding. So I guess what the issue becomes is we're talking about the transition in Israel's policy when it moves from one position toward Iran, toward another. To what extent is it anticipating the rain before it rains, or is its response a real and effective one given the fact that it is raining today on this particular day?
I think there's a third aspect.
Yeah.
To what extent is it anticipating the rain? To what extent was the rain real? To what extent did the umbrella bring out the rain?
Yeah, right.
I would say that if you take a look at the situation at the time, it's not realistic to be able to say that Iran posed a significant threat to Israel at the time. For several reasons. Its conventional military was not in that shape. And secondly, it actually did not have a good relationship with the Palestinians at the time. Hamas was a Sunni organization coming out of the Egyptian Brotherhood that had very poor relations with Iran. PLO had very, very poor relations with Iran throughout the 1980s because it was a secular pan-Arab, Arab nationalist organization. And both of these Palestinian factions sided with Saddam Hussein during the war. So in spite of all of Iran's rhetoric standing with the Palestinians, he had very poor relations with the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. The relationship with the Palestinians emerged as a result of the peace process and the effort that went along with the peace process, which was to isolate Iran in the region. Very similar to what we have today with Annapolis, in which the primary objective of Annapolis seems to be isolate Iran, not necessarily peacemaking between Israelis and Palestinians. So there was, and perhaps, an excessive anticipation of a potential Iranian threat. They didn't have a nuclear program. They didn't have the missiles. They didn't have the conventional threat. They didn't have the relationship with the Palestinians. They did have one thing, which was the relationship with Hezbollah, though. But it served a political purpose. The Israelis, however, that I've spoken to, advisors to Rabin, etc., did not anticipate that using Iran as a political argument would have the consequence of making Iran look at Israel as a greater threat. And there was a commission, a committee put together by the Israelis a couple of years into Israel shifting its policy, depicting Iran as a global threat, pressuring the United States to sanction Iran and not talk to Iran. A committee was put into place to assess what was the Iranian threat and what could Israel do. And the recommendation was stop talking so much about Iran, because Israel's focus on Iran had caused Iran to focus more on Israel. It was creating a problem. It was becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. And you had significant Israeli politicians at the time, including Ehud Barak and others, coming out and saying Rabin and Peres' excessive rhetoric about Iran was creating a problem rather than solving it.
So to pick up on the metaphor, at a certain point, it is the case that the umbrella causes the rain, actually.
There's an Israeli recognition that that was the case. Now we're in a different situation.
Yeah.
Whether that was the case or not, people can discuss. Many people in Israel credit Netanyahu, for instance, for stopping the rhetoric against Iran for the first 9 months. But now there's a sense that the threat is there. So whether Israel contributed to making it or not, it becomes a secondary issue from the Israeli perspective. Now the reality is that there is a sense that Iran is a threat. Iran does have the capabilities. It's not necessarily so, in my view, that Iran would be irrational and start a war, etc. But there is very few voices in Israel that are saying, don't worry about this. This is made up to be bigger than it actually is. By now, there is a recognition that there is a real problem.
You make reference to the in 2004, the Project Daniel, which was completed under Sharon, which essentially argues for a doctrine of preemption on Israel's part, so that when you have a fear, you need to act to prevent it and nip it in the bud.
Yes. Project Daniel, I think, is a project that, if you take a look at the thinking, the perspective, it's extremely similar, if not identical, to the perspective of the neoconservative movement in the United States. The emphasis on preemption, the emphasis on the idea that the nature of a regime is inherent on how the behavior of the regime is. You cannot change the behavior of a regime that has the wrong nature. You can only change it. You can only defeat it. You can only eliminate it. And in that document, I think there's tremendous simplifications that are being made that in the long run are going to be, not even in the long run, in the short term, in the medium term, are going to be very negative for Israel itself. They're lumping all the Arab states together with Iran. They're arguing that the Arabs and the Iranians inherently are irrational. And as a result, you cannot have deterrence. Because if you cannot, you need to have a rational actor on the other side in order to be able to deter them. And if you cannot deter the other side, then you cannot have a policy of containment. You can only have a policy of elimination and preemption, and in reality, preventive measures. Because preemption would indicate that there is an attack about to happen, which is not the case necessarily. Prevention means that you're going to take care of it decades before it even potentially could become a problem.
Bottom line, when you read your book, you're left with the impression that what then becomes very important for both Israel and Iran is their relationship to the United States, getting its ear, winning its support and its understanding. And throughout the book, you are showing examples during this period we're discussing where really Iran loses out. They're kept out of the Madrid process. Today, in the last few days, they've not been invited to the Annapolis conference. The war on terrorism, which we adopted after 9/11, has a nice fit with the way Israel came to view the problem of terrorism, because in fact Iran did turn to supporting terrorism as it was isolated and contained. Talk a little about the importance of winning U.S. support, and explain to us why which side wins over the other.
It is critical because at the end of the day, as we spoke earlier on, the United States is the sole global power, superpower. And the Iranians could not attain the position that they were hoping for in the region if they were constantly at odds with the United States. Now, their conclusion has been somewhat different, though, in the sense that every effort they've made so far to help the United States, to aid the United States, to come to terms with the United States, has, after a period, turned out to backfire on them. There's several good examples. One is actually the Madrid Conference, in which the Iranians, prior to that, were helping the United States against Iraq, hoping that they would be included in the process, and then they ended up being excluded. In Afghanistan, the Iranians probably provided the U.S. with the most important help that they've ever provided the U.S. with, because they were the ones who had been fighting the Taliban for more than a decade almost, and they had extensive relations with the anti-Taliban forces. They supported the United States. They gave tremendous amount of political support to the U.S. internally in Afghanistan, and they've been credited as being the ones who won the peace for the United States in Afghanistan. 6 weeks after the conference in Bonn, in which the U.S. and Iran closely coordinated their efforts and they got a new constitution in Afghanistan, the United States put Iran into the axis of evil. This shocked Tehran, and this helped rise, strengthen the hands of those in Iran going into the internal elements, the hands of those in Iran who were arguing from the very outset, you cannot get the United States to accept you, you cannot get the United States to recognize Iran as a legitimate power and come to terms with Iran by helping the U.S. You can only do so by making it as costly as possible for the United States not to do so. So whenever the U.S. is pursuing a policy of isolation, make it costly for the U.S. to pursue a policy of isolation. And those are the factions that oftentimes have ended up winning out because the moderate elements failed to deliver the United States.
It sounds to me that it becomes very important for supporters of Israel or the supporters of Iran to influence American foreign policy in the United States.
Certainly. And there the Iranians really have no cards to play. The Jewish community does have extensive presence. They've been in this country, obviously, much, much longer. They are integral part of American society and American political system. Iran has a completely different situation. They don't even have a diplomatic relationship with the United States. They cannot do any lobbying or anything of that sort. So they have completely lacked presence in a critical arena, which is the arena of American foreign policy making. So they've oftentimes ended up in a situation in which they're being able to provide help to the United States in the region in the hope that that automatically would cause the United States to reciprocate. But not having a foot in the American foreign policymaking arena, that has put them in a very disadvantageous position and helped the pro-Israeli elements who felt that if the United States and Iran were to work together, if they made a deal, the United States would sacrifice Israeli security interests in order to achieve a deal with the Iranians. And they have acted against those deals and oftentimes managed to scuttle them.
You are head of the National Iranian American Council. What is the goal of that group, and how does it impact this process?
The National Iran American Council was put together by me and a couple of other individuals in Washington, D.C., right after 9/11. It was a reaction to 9/11 in which we were shocked to see that the Iranian American community that was so much against what happened at 9/11 had such a hard time voicing their support for the United States and their opposition to terror. They basically lacked a voice in the United States, and we said that it's important to educate the community on how they can gain that. We did not aim to be the voice. We aimed to help the community raise its civic participation level, start adopting democratic values, and be part of the democratic process. I mean, one of the things that was shocking to us is that in the United States, the community here has access to one of the best political systems in the world. It has democracy here. It's been in this country because it didn't have democracy in Iran, but it is not taking advantage. It's not participating in the democracy over here. So that's what we wanted to promote. As the organization evolved, however, and we became the largest Iranian-American grassroots organization, pressure started to come on us from our community that we should start taking positions on various issues. And the one issue that has been important for our community, very much so, is to avoid an unnecessary military conflict between the United States and Iran. And I think Iranian Americans oftentimes see themselves as double stakeholders in this. as Americans, they don't want to see a single American life being lost in such an unnecessary war. As Americans of Iranian descent, they don't also want to see their grandmothers being bombed by the United States. So they have double staking, making sure that this conflict can be resolved in a peaceful manner.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this possibility of war, but let's put it in the context of nuclear weapons. As a realist, and I guess I'm a realist also, isn't it almost inevitable that a power such as Iran that feels so threatened would go for nuclear weapons, whatever it's saying it's doing or not? And then if it did, would it matter?
I think that's a very, very important question that oftentimes is not being asked. And I would say on the first part of your question, it was a critical phrase that you use, a power like Iran that is feeling that it's threatened. That's critical because there's two factors right now, I think, that are important to understand the Iranian nuclear program. On the one hand, Iran would actually lose significant strategic value if it did go for a nuclear weapon. And I explain why. Iran has managed to play a critical role in the region, a preeminent role in the region, for the last 3,000 years, more often than not, precisely because of its conventional natural superiority. It is one of the largest countries, it has one of the largest land masses, one of the largest populations, and a tremendous amount of natural resources, and a history of statehood. If Iran, however, were to go for a nuclear bomb, it could spark an arms race. And it could, unfortunately, if whether they like it or not, it would most likely project a threat to many of its neighbors. And some of these neighbors, much smaller neighbors, as an example, perhaps Kuwait, could either opt to go for a nuclear bomb or buy a nuclear bomb. And if then Kuwait and a couple of other states do so, Iran would lose its national superiority, precisely because Iran and Kuwait would then be at strategic parity because both can destroy the other. And then Iran would lose its legitimate claim to be able to say Iran deserves to be a preeminent power. So strategically, going for a nuclear weapon for a country like Iran in that regional setting where it has a natural superiority conventionally is a very negative thing. And I don't think it's a surprise that the two most populous nations in the region, Iran and Egypt, in 1974, initiated this effort to create a nuclear-free Middle East because they are the ones who would lose out the most if the Middle East became nuclearized. They are the ones that have the least comparative advantage for a nuclear weapon. A small state, however, does have a comparative advantage for a nuclear weapon. Mm-hmm. And that's where the phrase that you mentioned comes in that makes it so important, because the one factor that most likely is pushing Iran towards that deterrence is the threat that the United States is posing to Iran in the Iranian perspective. That's the one threat that Iran lacks an effective deterrence against. And that's the one threat, one factor that could overcome this other driving force that is going against a nuclear weapon and cause the Iranians to go for it. What the Iranians are doing right now and what they were doing during the time of the Shah, I think, is very similar. They're going for a capability. They're going to be standing at the edge of having a nuclear weapon, but they're not going to go for a weapon unless they sense that there is an imminent threat, because they recognize the very negative effects it would have for Iran strategically if they unnecessarily went for a nuclear weapon.
If you look at the American domestic political scene, there seems to be, with the exception of your organization and the Iranian community, little support broadly based to change the containment isolation policy of Iran. How do you make a compelling argument like you just made politically acceptable in the American debate?
Well, actually, I would say that there's a really interesting shift taking place right now, and I think it's because we're at a geopolitical climax. The cost of pursuing an unsuccessful policy for a couple of more years is becoming exponentially greater than it was just in the last few years. So more and more groups are coming out. More and more presidential candidates are saying that they favor diplomacy, they want to see negotiations, and they want to see a new equation with Iran. And this is quite unprecedented. You did certainly not have this in the last elections, and certainly not in 2000 either. But I think the most important argument in this sense is that the policy of trying to create a stable order in the Middle East based on the exclusion of some of the most powerful states is doomed to fail. It is simply not possible because it goes against the geopolitical forces of gravity. Because a policy of excluding powerful states give those states incentives to undermine U.S. foreign policy and U.S. interest in the region. And in the case of Iran, it's quite obvious. Iran does have the capabilities to undermine U.S. policy. It's done so on numerous occasions. And it's oftentimes a function of Iran being excluded. And even if the policy was aimed at excluding Israel or a small state, it would be equally problematic in my view. They may not have the same capabilities to undermine it, but you cannot create a stable order in the Middle East based on the exclusion of some major powers. Imagine trying to create a new order in Europe, a new stable, peaceful Europe, based on the exclusion of Germany. Mm-hmm. Where would that have gotten the United States? The United States did the exact opposite. It recognized that it needed to integrate Germany into Europe in order to ensure that it would be peaceful.
Despite this policy of containment and isolation, isn't it fair to say that the thing that has enhanced Iran's power more than anything else was the debacle in Iraq?
The debacle in Iraq, the defeat of the Taliban, has in many ways accentuated Iran's power. Mm-hmm. But more than anything else, it has limited American power. And in that sense, in relative terms, the Iranians have ended up in a much more important position. And it's had a ripple effect in the sense that many of the countries in the region that depend on American security, that depend on American hegemony, they've ended up in a very difficult position because they have not only lost faith in American power, but they lost faith in American competence. And that's a very dangerous position to be in if you want to be the security provider of this region.
Mm-hmm. How does one make known in the United States the complexity of the debate in Israel? Because one of the virtues in your book, as you go through this historical period from the time of the Shah to the present, is that you reveal the real subtlety of the Israeli debate with some of the most interesting arguments not winning out, and sort of almost an inexorable movement toward this very dark, negative view of Iran, which then impacts the U.S. debate.
It truly is fascinating when you really scratch the surface and you see how the debate has been in Israel. And I had great access in Israel, and part of the reason for that was because when I went to Israel, I got a lot of help from my professors at Hopkins, including Eliot Cohen. But also, I had just come from Iran. And when I approached two Israelis, I said, well, I would like to talk to you. I just came from Iran, and I did about 40 great interviews with Iranian officials about Israel. Do you have time to chat? And almost everyone did.
That's right.
And it was truly revealing because I got probably 30% of the valuable information from my interviews with Israelis. 70% of the information that was valuable to me was to listen to the questions they had for another hour after my interview. Mm-hmm. That was truly revealing of what they were really concerned about. And I think gave me great insights of what their thinking was and what their calculations and their fears were. But there's been a tremendously interesting debate in Israel. It's been very fascinating to see in what direction it's gone. And right now, I think we're in a stage in which Israel currently is going on autopilot. Israel is in a state of strategic paralysis. It is pursuing a policy based on the idea that the chessboard has not changed, but it has. They're pursuing a policy as if Lebanon did not happen last year, as if Iraq did not happen, as if the United States is in the same position that it was only a couple of years ago, as if Iran does not have 3,000 centrifuges. And it's devastating for Israel, in my view. I think it's very dangerous. But there's no political leader so far that has shown the courage of coming out and saying, look, plan A did not work. We have to focus on a plan B. That's very costly within Israel's political domestic scene to be able to do so. But you do have voices outside of the political sphere. The former Israeli officials, such as Ephraim Halevi, the former head of Mossad, Shlomo Ben-Ami, the former foreign minister, who have come out and said these things, including, by the way, the current Israeli foreign minister, Livni, who has come out indirectly or directly, leaked information saying Iran is deterrable. That's a critical sentence. Because if the Israelis say, which I know that they believe, most of them, Iran is the terrible, then that paves the way for completely new policy options. But it also means that pressure is off of the United States to pursue Plan A, which is to do something drastic about Iran's nuclear program. Mm-hmm. And that's the fear in Israel. How will this play out internally in Israel? And B, if Israel comes out and says, we can resolve Iran in a different way, what will that do in the United States? How will that affect the U.S. foreign policy direction? And will the pressure will be off of the United States to really take a very harsh position against Iran?
What about the story within Iran? That is, that there's no evidence at the present time that there is a reformist leadership that can take the initiative to move in a positive direction. And of course, I have to preface that by saying that when these opportunities have emerged within Iran under Rafsanjani or under Khatami, we haven't responded, and then their position has eroded.
That's true, but at the same time, there has been numerous cases in which the United States has reached out to Khatami, for instance, and there was the Iranians that didn't respond. The Iranians lost a lot of opportunities mm-hmm. as well. Same thing with Rafsanjani during 1996, because then it was actually Benjamin Netanyahu who was reaching out to Iran. Mm-hmm. He didn't believe in the peace process, so he felt that he needed to have some sort of relationship with Iran, somewhat of a reflective of the periphery thinking again. And the Iranians were not interested. Mm-hmm. So there's enough blame to go around, although I would say that in the last couple of years, the United States has lost tremendous opportunities. And those lost opportunities has, as you pointed out, eroded the position of the more pragmatic elements and directly affected the rise of the more radical elements such as Ahmadinejad right now. Right now, I would say that you would have a hard time seeing a pragmatic force in Iran rising, coming to a prominent position in Iran's foreign policy circles unless there is a shift on the American side. I think the policy of increasing the threat and the danger with the calculation that that will cause the pragmatists to win internally in Iran is quite erroneous. It's going to end up being false, I believe, because it's precisely the threat and the sense that the pragmatists have failed to alleviate that threat that feeds in and strengthens the radical elements in Iran.
You're bringing to our discussion, you know, real insight on the domestic situations in both Iran and Israel, and obviously your realist perspective is very informative and insightful, and I'm just I want to get at this at the human level to help people understand this. We seem to be heading over a cliff. By that I mean all of us, the countries we've been talking about in the United States, you know, and on the one hand we have Israel, the Jews having suffered the Holocaust, never being recognized, you know, over these many years, feeling an existential threat. On the other hand, you have conservative reactionary forces in Iran who use language which may be for political purposes and not operational, but on the other hand, in this kind of environment, it's hard to say what is really meant by the words.
Sure.
All of this in a context in which one country is pushing ahead with nuclear weapons, and in the context in which the great superpower seems to be confused and often ignorant about the realities on the ground in the Middle East and so on. So where is the hope? Where can we bring the insight and the information to the table to lead to decisions that will kind of change the behavior on the Israeli side and on the Iranian side?
Let me first say one thing on the Holocaust comments, and I think you're absolutely right. These statements coming out of Ahmadinejad is creating a tremendous amount of anxiety and fear in Israel for quite understandable reasons. And I think in many ways, Ahmadinejad has actually crossed even a line that the Iranian government had about the limits of its excessive rhetoric on Israel. Because in 1979, one thing we shouldn't forget is that Iran still holds the largest Jewish community in the region outside of Israel. Still 25,000 Jews living in Iran. They've been living there for 2,500 years. They are an integral part of Iran's history, its culture, its politics, its society, and everything. But in 1979, the Iranian Jewish community's leaders approached Khomeini with a proposal, basically asking Khomeini to issue a fatwa, a religious decree, that the Jews of Iran are to be protected in the Islamic Republic as a recognized people. And in return, the Jews of Iran would remain quite anti-Zionist because the Jews of Iran had never really been very strongly pro-Zionist. Khomeini accepted the proposal, issued the fatwa, and ever since, the Jews have essentially been protected. They have their schools, etc., numerous synagogues in Iran. Certainly, there's a tremendous amount of problems being of any religious minority or political minority in Iran. I don't want to minimize that, but it's still an interesting situation there. But the Holocaust comments, that goes beyond political opposition to Israel. That is attacking the very core of the Jewish people's experience. And that is something a lot of people inside of Iran itself has been feeling very uncomfortable with, including people inside the Iranian government. And one of the things that I think, in my view, has cast a very dark shadow over the Iranian nation with these comments is the fact that Iranian diplomats in France during the Second World War were actually helping French Jews flee to Iran and flee from the Nazis by providing them with Iranian passports. And there's been a long history of that. Almost every Iraqi Jew that is in Israel today fled through Iran, and the Iranian government was helping Israel be able to repatriate many of the Jews. So there's been a long history of friendship between the two peoples, and the Holocaust comments is casting a very, very dark shadow over that. But as to your question of what can be done right now, I think the dangerous position that we're in right now is it's basically 1914. It's 1938, some people are saying. It's 1914. We have discarded diplomacy, and I think that's certainly true for some of the aspects of the current administration's foreign policy. We have abandoned foreign policy making to military strategy, and particularly this idea of preemption that is not prevalent in the United States is part of that. So a single shot, just like in 1914, can cause a major, spark a major conflict in the region. And what we need in order to be able to offset that, what we need to make sure that these power shifts, these very, very large power shifts, do not end up in a major geopolitical war, is to have a tremendous amount of diplomatic activity. Because if we don't, unfortunately, war can become inevitable. Because these shifts rarely take place peacefully unless there is diplomacy. And unfortunately, right now, I wouldn't characterize the foreign policies of Iran, Israel, or the United States as being characterized by diplomacy.
Trito, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being on our program. I want to show your book again to our audience and recommend it highly as something to read and stay informed about the current situation we're in. Thank you again.
Thank you so much. Appreciate
thank you.
It.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.